Professor Hoffman, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here.
Can you give us some detail on how indigo came to be valued throughout time and civilization?
So there are some species of snails in the Mediterranean and off the coast of Peru, from a gland of which, if you take that gland out and if you go through some chemistry, which those cultures mastered, the Phoenicians and the South Americans, you can get a blue pigment. You can also get a very similar one produced by plants.
I wonder how many snail glands it would take to make one pair of blue jeans.
About 10,000. A rather messy process. That is why the Romans controlled tightly the industry of the snail indigo in Phoenicia. And they controlled it so that the snail indigo was available only to dye the Roman generals in triumph toga in a perfect purple. It is said that a gram of that indigo, which was enough to dye one toga, was worth about 3 years of wages of a baker.
Much like tea, it's been the source of wars over history as well, and slavery.
Yes, and when Gandhi went to India, returned from South Africa, he worked among and organized some of the indigo farmers that the British had instituted. And the indigo industry was the plant indigo was being put out of existence by the synthetic indigo, and there was a lot of unrest around there.
Has that process been completed now, or is indigo still grown at all for its use as a dye?
It's still grown as a craft, as a hobby, but the only place in the world where there is a commercial plant indigo industry is Japan. Part of Japanese culture is that fabrics for traditional clothing worn at a wedding or such should be colored with plant indigo.
But for the rest of us comfortable in our Levi's, when was it first widely used as a synthetic dye?
Its chemical structure was obtained in 1870, and by 1890, the German dyestuffs industry was producing great amounts of synthetic indigo. Within about 10, 20 years, it began to displace the plant indigo.
Let's talk more about your work, Professor, where you're often involved in this nexus between science and art and history and economics and all facets.
It is important to me. It's been important to me since college at Columbia, where I never got over a core curriculum that had humanities and arts as well as science. I have another career as a writer of everything except fiction.
Do you encourage aspiring chemists to also broaden their base and interests, much like you've done, or do you consider yours a fairly unique talent in that regard?
I actually think that many scientists have some other passion. They're probably afraid to talk about it. Yes, I want to encourage them. I certainly make them come out of the closet, so to speak. When I go somewhere and I talk to chemists, I find out this guy has a vibraphone quartet he's playing, and another one paints. And I wish there would be more valuation of those, to me, spiritual activities in addition to their science.
If I'm hearing you correctly, it's almost as if there is a reticence among some, in this case chemists, to reveal that they have these other passions as well. Is it perhaps because they feel it might compromise the integrity of their principal work?
Yes, maybe, but it's a misplaced feeling, so I don't think it'll compromise anything. It'll humanize them. Science is a wonderful system for getting reliable knowledge, but it's a system that does it using fallible human beings who perhaps become better human beings ethically, I would like to think, actually, while they do the science. And I think that one should not expect scientists to be different from other people. A spiritual side to us is very important.
Professor Hoffman, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks. I'm pleased to talk with you.
That's Nobel Prize-winning chemist and Cornell University Professor Emeritus Roald Hoffman.